Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Lowdown. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Don Scott. Don, big warm welcome to the show.
Thank you, Connor. Good to see you again.
Likewise. Don, as we begin with every guest that comes on, could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Oh, that's a good one. Probably a very English term of jumpers for goalposts, of being, I don't know, covered head to toe in mud, basically, and just being on a field around the back of the house with the boys, no other girls, and literally like jumpers or whatever else we were wearing, we could take off, for the two girls at either end. So yeah, probably that. Like that is always a vision I have when I think about that house, that we lived in Washington, and yeah, just being out on the street, yeah, just playing with the boys from as soon as I got home from school until, you know, like mum and dad are at the door shouting for me to kind of come in and, you know, it's time to go to bed.
And obviously, I mean, you've gone on to make your career building high performance departments, working in sports science. However, like when you got into the FA, it was heady enough days in 2001, obviously, to lead up the sports science department, relatively new. Was that always on the cards for yourself to have a broader career in football, or was it just a case, was it very intentional, or was it an offspring of, I wanted to be a footballer, that didn't pan out, go on to do something else?
Probably neither of those. Like, I never had the ambition of being a football player because I didn't know I could. I feel like the years I was growing up, I was born in the 70s, there was no role models. There was no women's football out there that you would see on TV. Probably the first matches I probably remember watching or seeing was like the 99 kind of World Cup in the US. And then, in terms of like sports science as a thing, like when I first went to uni, I actually got it wrong twice in terms of which subjects I went to. I started physics because I thought I wanted to be a physics teacher. And then, after the first year, was sat in second year and was in an astronomy kind of class that I'd chosen. And I just remember thinking, one, I'm surrounded by, you know, very intelligent looking people, males. I was the only female in there. And where's this going to take me? So, managed to change courses, actually then started accountancy because my subjects at school A levels were very much STEM, so like scientific, science, technology, engineering, math. So I did maths, physics, electronics A levels. So I did accountancy because I like maths, but you know, there's also business and law, and again after the first year of passing it wasn't really that taken with it. And then I heard of this thing called sports science, which again was pretty new at that time. Like Liverpool, John Moores, who which was Liverpool Polytechnic at the time, had a sports science course. But also I applied to Crewe and Alsager, which is now Manchester Metropolitan University, and did sports science there. Again, at the end of that course, didn't really know what an applied sports scientist was, didn't know you could work in sport, if I'm honest, even though you'd done that course. And there happened to be a funded master's program in Aberdeen in sports nutrition. So I went and did that. Again, gave me a bit more time to think about what I was going to do, and then taught a bit of like sports studies at Aberdeen College when I was up there. So they were great skills to, you know, kind of learn and try like different ways of delivering information to the students, etc. And then even when I finished there, I think there was one role that was linked to kind of sport and football. There was a master's at Teesside University where it was going to be working in Middlesbrough Football Club, and like I was like, wow, like what is this role? It just felt like the dream role at the time, and then I didn't get it, and I just remember being absolutely gutted, and then couldn't find any other jobs like that anywhere. And so then there was a role at Worcester University lecturing in sports science, so I did that. And while I was there was two other colleagues there who had an interest in football, and you know, we got to know a little bit about women's football in England, and we would do our kind of courses, lecturing, etc. And then we wrote letters, because again, emails weren't really a thing back then, to the women's premier teams, and just said, would they be interested in us coming in to fitness test the players and do some kind of dietary recall and nutrition support? And they all said yes. So we would literally do our lecture and then we'd drive off and do the testing. There was one team in particular, Southampton Saints, and I just continued that support. The head of football at the time, Vanessa Rainbird, just said, could you do some education? Could you do some training program implementation with the players? So Again, I did that. It was all voluntary. I did manage myself and Mark Todd, one of the others. We went off to Australia and presented it, some of it at the World Congress on Science and Football in Sydney, like in the, oh my goodness, 90s. So yeah, and then kind of towards the end of my few years there, a job came up at the FA, which was exercise scientist with the England women's football team. And I applied for it. And also when I was doing this kind of research at Worcester Uni, I used to write to Hope Powell, who was the manager of England at the time, and share some of the data, just say, did you know about the fitness levels of the players, and you know, how can we get them fitter and the demands of the game, etc. And yeah, obviously she was England manager at the time, and so I applied and I got it. And you know, she told me she gave me the job because she was sick of me writing to her. But you know, in reality, if you think about back then, I was probably, not that it had to be a female, but I was probably one of the few, if only, like female who had an interest in football and who had done sports science. There was also Helena Andersson, who was Swedish and, you know, has worked with the Swedish FA and the US women previously. But yeah, and so I got that role, and that was my first experience of applying the sports science into sport, and obviously specifically into football.
Amazing. I actually didn't know that. Writing all the
Yeah.
letters to one girl was about
Yeah.
speaking. What kinds of
Certainly
tricks?
shows my age. Like, people these days wouldn't know how to write letters, because obviously technology and communication has changed so much.
Yeah, speak of taking the initiative, but that is a good point, because if we look at sports science space nowadays, Dawn, it's crazy. Kind of fast forward nearly 25, 30 years later, you look at advances of technology combined with the commercialization of the sport. We've kind of rapidly evolved to a space where it's kind of all about marginal gain, so on and so forth. But obviously, as you said, migrating into that role with the FA at the time, obviously, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. I was supposed to apply the theory into practice. Could you take us through perhaps a bit of the workload that you were able to do with the FA at the time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I kind of went into a department, at a large department. Again, there was myself, two other females, Caroline Woods, who was a physio and doing some of the research and the injury surveillance projects that the FA were doing. And then there was another physio, Louise Fawcett, who again got employed at the same time, and kind of myself and Louise were the two who really supported the England team, the women's team, from the start, with Pippa Bennett, the doctor. Other than that, everybody else in the department was male, but some, you know, amazing people, mentors for me, because again, at that time, there was no, you know, kind of women working in that space, or people working in the applied women's, yeah, kind of the applied arena for females, for women. So I worked with people like Rich Hawkins, who obviously, you know, is still at, I think, Manchester United, Mark Hulse, who's worked in many Premier teams, and Manchester United Academy, Tony Strudwick, who was with Sir Alex Ferguson for a long time. Oh my goodness, Sam Erith, who was at Man City, came out to the US for a bit, and I believe is interim at Manchester United. So worked alongside some amazing practitioners who had done that role. So in some ways, I learned from them a little bit. But then I also remember going to my first ever England women's training camp. I think we were in Hull, and I think it was against Denmark. And I remember first training session thinking, like, what is my role? I don't know what to do. Like, they'd never had sports science support. Like, if you think about, I don't know, a doctor or a physio role, or, you know, a technical coach, like, you know what they, now we do, back then, again, we do. Like, you kind of need the physio and the, you know, the doctor to get the players prepared, ready to be on the field, to monitor them during whatever. Like, at that time, for applied sports science, I didn't know, it wasn't clear. So I pretty much watched for a few days, if not the whole camp. And then at the end of the camp, proposed to Hope and the other coaches, this is where I feel like this role can add value, and this is what I can do. And also at that time, the players were all, you know, amateur. They were pretty much like full-time careers roles. You know, we had somebody in the police, a teacher, people who worked in the kit department of some of their clubs, a whole range of a post woman. So they were, that was their careers first and foremost, and they trained and played on top of there. So a big part of it was education. How can we educate the players to become better players? You know, the whole realm, like, I like talking about the aggregation of, you know, the marginal gains of, like, what things are going to impact a player's performance. And so you look at the whole spectrum of, the whole multidisciplinary team support. So where can we add value? So again, giving them training programs, supplying them with a heart rate watch. So now we can program it with heart rate zones to try and, kind of get the most out of their training, et cetera, and to help to educate the players. So education was a big part of it. I think the other part was, Hope Powell was amazing at getting funding for the team and getting resources and getting additions. So 2005, we hosted the European Championships in England. And ahead of that time, it was like, okay, blank slate, like what things would help the players get ready physically, technically, kind of mentally for that tournament. So again, starting to like research what things would help with their performance, etc. We were a very small staff. Like that probably first staff group going to the 2005 Euros was probably, I don't know, eight, nine staff of like head coach, assistant goalkeeper, like three max, kit person, admin person, physio, one doctor, myself, an immediate person. So, there was probably nine staff full time around the team supporting. And you just did it all yourself. Like again, some of it born from the passion of women's football, the passion and the pride of hosting a home European Championships, and you wanted the team to do well. And so yeah, so you just kind of worked it out to set, okay, this works, this doesn't work. So you make, I made mistakes, or I tried things that didn't work, or introduce things that weren't really practical. And again, it was figuring out what was going to, like you said, the low hanging fruit, what might have most impact now and easiest to implement, what might take longer, but longer term have impact. Like a big thing is if we want the players to get stronger, they need to do strength work. Who do they do that with when they're scattered all over the country? So we had a period of time where some of the best qualified people in some of the regions were people who worked in the prisons, the prison guards, who were physical trainers in the prisons, and they had access to gyms, and they had the Baller British Weightlifting Association qualification because we'd worked with Barry Beasley at FA at Lillishall, and he kind of built out and taught some of the strength work, which a lot of it was in Olympic lifting, but also just some of the principles of strength work. So again, we had a period of time where some of our players would, kind of train with some of those PTs at the different prisons because they had the facilities and, they had the expertise, so that we knew the players were being trained by somebody who was qualified and experienced to be able to do some of that. So again, it was how could you get the players what they need? Sometimes think outside the box, sometimes do it with little resource, little funding. And again, if, I don't know, there was a X £1,000 of what we could bid in for, like what would be the highest priority thing that we would want from that?
It's amazing to me to hear and just listen to you speak about kind of the scaffolding of learning when you enter that environment. Because nowadays, if you look at a college graduate or perhaps someone else from a different club moving to a new federation, to a new club, like I do question at times if that peer-to-peer support is there. So then you're just relying off the theoretical, but being able to rely both off the peer-to-peer and the theoretical, being able to combine it together, it just makes learning a lot more real and live, Don.
Yeah, I agree. And I think in some ways, like I say this a lot, like the women's game at the moment, women's football is grown exponentially. Like there's so many professional leagues around the world, but I don't yet think the environment is fully professionalized, as in there is increased fund and budgets for some, but not all. You probably look at the top, I don't know, 5% of women's teams or players are the elite end, but you've also got these other 95% who are not there yet. And so they don't have the budget, they don't have the resources, they don't have the staffing, they don't have the expertise. I've just been on a kind of workshop for a couple of days where we speak about female health and the female athlete and pelvic health and pelvic floor, which pelvic health, pelvic floor are crucial generally, for females, but also specifically postpartum, post-pregnancy. But how many clubs, other than maybe the 5%, have the expertise or even the budget or the funding resource to bring in that expertise? So Yes, you still do have to think outside the box, but then there are some environments where, you have a big staff and you have all of these specialists and you don't have to think outside the box. And in some ways, I don't know, like it's almost like you're not necessarily challenged to, I don't know, find a way of doing it. It's almost like a textbook of this is how we're going to do it. But I just think the environment is so like different. It changes all the time. The game changes all the time. Like you train and like you can have a periodized model, but it needs to be dynamic. It needs to be changeable because your week to week is different. If you have a midweek game and you have a midweek game every week, which again, some of those top tier women's teams do have, like you can't have a tactical periodization or a, straightforward periodization. It needs to be adaptable. And but also, how do you treat your starting players, your game changers who accumulate a few minutes, and then your players who are getting no minutes, or your development players, even in the US now, like where you look at the there's no college draft anymore. So you are now seeing a lot of younger players, Oliver Mutrie at Portland Thorns was almost like the trailblazer and the first one here of a younger player joining a women's pro team. So, as well, how are you treating those players? There's a 14-year-old, I think she is at Gotham, who made a debut this season. So how is she being treated, compared to all of these others? So have you got that individual lens on all of them? And, even the practitioners in there, what is their expertise? Is it male players? Is it female players? Okay, if it's female players, is it adult players? Is it youth players? Because even the development of your senior players is very different to a youth player. And again, if I don't know, if you've got your youth players who are in now with some of those NWSL teams and they're not getting playing time, how are they on the same rhythm as the rest of the team when the rest of the team is preparing for that game, but then this player isn't getting playing time? How is that being adapted, and do clubs have the capacity and scope to support those players? So,
Yeah,
sorry, I think I went on a very big tangent then.
not at all. I think it's really, really important context. It's nearly as if, you obviously don't want to be bound by not old and proven frameworks, but I think that's probably does speak to your longevity in the game and success within it too, and probably the best that you've worked alongside being prepared to shatter previous paradigms for the pursuit of what's better, what's more, just being able to adapt and see the problem or approach the problem with a fresh pair of eyes.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing for me where I continually look at that. And Jill Ellis, when we won the World Cup in 2015, and I think it was a John Wooden quote, it was, okay, we've won, but if you sit still, you're going to get taken over. So you've always got to think about the next one. So again, okay, you win the 2015 World Cup. How can we then prepare the players and the team to be ready for the next World Cup in 2019? And one, there was a transition of players, so straight away with that already, when you've got the likes of Abby Wambach retiring, Heather O'Reilly, although after the next Olympics, Shannon Box, Christy Pearce, you've got some big players leaving that group. And then you've got the likes of Lindsay Horan, Mallory Pugh, Rose Lavelle, kind of coming in. So in some ways, you've got that natural change of how you are or how you have to be, because now, those more kind of senior older players, you would treat them very differently to these younger players coming in. Like, Rose Lavelle, we had to put a lot of support around her about what she does off the field, like her lifestyle, her habits, her nutrition. She had a lot of injuries. So again, how can we maybe modify what she's doing to make sure she is ready? Like, you look at her debut against England, the She Believes Cup, which I think was in 2016 or 2017, and she doesn't look strong. And then now you look at her, where like it takes time to kind of build, but it's not just the training you do, in the gym or on the field or anything like that. It's everything off the pitch that is going to have an impact. Same with Lindsay Horan, like she was the first, I think, who forego college in the US to go. Lindsay Heaps now, sorry, she just got married. Who forgo college in the US and went pro straight away as 16 or 17-year-old with PSG. And I remember when she was there, like I would be on calls with her to try and help her kind of do strength work. Like they had a certain philosophy over there and they didn't do some of that work with the club. So it was things like got her a TRX and some simple bits of equipment that she could do at home, and do some simple exercises. So, and then when she made the decision to come back, we brought her to LA for a few days and, did some physical profile and then, again, just worked alongside her with the education, the training, the whole recovery, nutrition, hydration, because she'd almost like missed out that whole athletic development because, most players will go to college and get some of that support. And I think that probably ties in nicely with what we just said there of she forego that and didn't get it and probably missed some windows of. So, yeah, I just think that real individual kind of lens is so important for each kind of player because they just have a, each player's situation or background or, chronological age, training age, physiology, and then add in, hormones and female physiology is so unique and different that for me, you have to give it the individual kind of lens and support of each player, like on and off the pitch.
And it's pretty remarkable that all that coincides with what was a fantastic, I suppose, 9 years, really it was, at US soccer between 2010 and 2019. We speak about longevity, but not only that, the consistency in terms of success. Participated in 5 international tournaments, 3 World Cups, 2 Olympics, taking home gold 3 times. So to win 3 major international tournaments within that period, success doesn't happen by chance. It's been one of the key cultural architects behind helping design and create that high performance environment. And what would you say were some of the key pillars behind such success?
Yeah, no, yeah, thank you for that. It's yeah, it was an unbelievable time and there's sometimes I sat here and think I'd love to, go through it again or have the opportunity now, where I guess like when I started out in 2001 and even in 2010 like the landscape was so different in terms of resources, staffing, budgets, etc. But I don't know, like I think when I ended it the with England, like the last year there, 2009, we reached the final of the European Championships and that had been like an accumulation of like Hope Howell, Brent Hills, Keith Rees were key players in that in terms of Mo Marley, like the work they'd all done in getting England to that final. But in the final, we then got beat pretty heavy by Germany 6-2. But also during that year, three key players for England, Karen Carney, Alex Scott, Kelly Smith, had moved to the US and were playing in the US League at that time, which I think that was the, I want to say that was the WPS because then the NWSL came in 2013. So obviously, like you've then got like women's football in the US, was always there, the number one ranked team in the world, obviously the Trailblazers, the previous success of the 99 group, and then really for the US 2003-7, got to semis but got beat. So yeah, when I joined in 2011 or kind of when I got the opportunity, again it came through Helena Anderson, who again I'd got to know on the just being a female in the applied sports science field and football. And she happened to be the fitness coach with the US women's team and was leaving and, just suggested my name to Pia. And it was the first time I'd ever had a full-time fitness coach, sports scientist, whatever you want to call me. And so, to go there, number one ranked team in the world, I think, again, my time with England, like, you built a lot of, like, resilience of having to always fight for things, a high work ethic of, just getting shit done because you worked as one and you didn't have funding to bring in other staff. So you just had to get it done. Like at times with England, I'd bounce around doing the seniors, the 19s, the 17s, because I almost was the sports science. So again, like a lot of resilience, fighting hard, getting things done, learning about preparing female players, what are the physical match demands, etc. So, then when I came to the US, like, again, you almost start that review process again of what have they got in place. I think you mentioned about having a framework, being truthful, Connor. I don't think there was a framework of support for applied sports science or even for like female players of what that was or should be. So again, when I started in 2010, it was a first like workshop to the players of this is really what sports science is. This is how it could help, how it, might help you individually. Again, for some, it was assessing where they were at from a physical fitness perspective, checking what they were doing off the pitch and to not checking, but finding out what they were doing off the pitch in terms of recovery, sleep, hydration, nutrition. For the O's, if you like them, Heather O'Reilly, Kelly O'Hara, who probably like the most fit players, like all round of like speed and endurance, strength. For them, their needs were very different to, some other players who maybe did need that kind of fitness development support, or other players who maybe need more technical, tactical support. So again, it was that whole interactional or the MDT support of each individual player of what each player needed, and then across our support team of who would lead on that if it was more technical tack or if it was physical or if it was more kind of off the pitch. Massive education process for the players, for the staff, looking at, I don't know, you're in hotels, what are the menus? Again, the GM used to do the menus for the team. There'd be cookies and cheesecake at every meal. So again, it was changing that. Also funny, when I came in, they had that typical streaky kind of crispy bacon. And I was like, whoa, no, we can't have that. We'll have like Canadian bacon. And I just remember I changed it for the next camp and there was uproar from the players. So again, it had to be a happy medium compromise of, of having that on some days. The other thing, post game, or sometimes the players would have pizza and I'd be like, no, like, coming from England where with the England women's team, we try and do everything so right because we still weren't there physically, technically, tactically. And so it was like, how can we get major marginal gains in other ways? Like even things where now you cringe a bit, like we'd have players wear caps in a warm-up or training to try and reduce like how much heat they gain from the sun if it was really hot. Whereas, with the US, it was kind of looking at gains in different ways because, physically, no doubt, and they had a physical presence, were probably the most physically fit team in the world. So, okay, if you've got a Kelly O'Hara or a Heather O'Reilly, who is that? How can we get them even fitter with maybe some of their recovery? Because some of those habits weren't great. And then, probably 5, 6 years in, it was then, finally also looking at the female health element of, like, when I think about my training in sports science, I think I had one-hour lecture on a female, like female physiology, female athlete. Also, as I already said, my subjects at school were STEM. So I hadn't really done biology, hadn't really done physiology. And so I self-learned a lot. I reached out to people who were experts in that area about the female physiology, about hormones, about menstrual cycle, and things what we should be monitoring or taking into account. And I really started that support with the US team around 2018. So again, it was always that thing of, right, 2015 have won the World Cup, right, we're consolidate, we're here, from regular profiling it, some of it being, schedule profiling, some of it being that invisible monitoring, when we know players are trending this way, in terms of physical, development, profiling, et cetera, what other areas can we help and support them in? And, through our wellness monitoring, we just start noticing some symptoms of sleep, just impacts of kind of sleep being less quality, less increased fatigue, and then increased muscle soreness for a few players. And then you start kind of monitoring some of the kind of menstrual cycle of when the player would be actually be on the period. And then I just start noticing it was in that window just before they started the period where for three or four players they did have some of these symptoms. So in 2019, myself and Julian Haig, who was a sports scientist, kind of working with me across the NWSL, every year we in pre-season we used to travel around the whatever 8 to 10 NWSL teams because it changed across the years, and we do fitness testing with the teams because even the NWSL teams didn't have that sports science support. Like in the first year in 2013, they would literally have a full-time head coach, and everybody else would be part-time or made up. Very few, if any, had a fitness coach, sports scientist. So at that time when it was still only me, I would just travel in and help support the coach. Do they have any questions? Maybe sometimes run a fitness session with the players. And then gradually over the years, like you would do education and the clubs would realize the importance of having that, fitness coach or sports scientist as well as like the medical support. So in 2019, myself and Julian traveled out to each of the NWSL teams, and as well as doing the profiling, we would also always deliver an education session, and we delivered them before on sleep, nutrition, recovery. And in 2019, we delivered one on female health, female physiology, and menstrual cycle. And it was just about explaining the hormones, the interaction, potential symptoms, and then that there was like strategies that they could employ that would actually reduce the severity of the symptoms. And also that if any of them felt they had any, I don't know, extreme or intense symptoms, they potentially should seek medical, kind of support around that. And again, me delivering, Julie went to five teams, I went to five. And, he said, like, players would be like, oh my God, like he's talking to us about periods and menstrual cycle. And, that, and I even had that, like, I had a players put their hoods up and slide down the chair because they were like, oh my goodness, she's talking to us about that. And so as soon ago as like 2018, 19, it was an embarrassing subject. It was a taboo subject, but we introduced it. We did it. It's about normalizing the conversation. It's about making it something that can be tracked and monitored. And so going into the World Cup, we then again monitored each individual, and the individual lens again is key. And based on individual symptoms that players experience, we would give them strategies to help to try and reduce or minimize those. And again, if you think a player might have menstrual cramps, muscle soreness, fatigue, some of that way you can support is, okay, dial up your recovery, what recovery are you doing this week? Or nutritionally, if you've got muscle soreness or kind of menstrual cramps, so kind of inflammation, okay, anti-inflammatory foods, and also how much saturated fat are you having, or how much sugary foods are you having that actually might make those symptoms worse. So again, working with the individual, if you're somebody who, because in the second half of your cycle, your core temperature increases. So if you're somebody who, in part because you're feeling a bit warmer, your sleep is impacted, what's your sleep hygiene like? What is the temperature in your room? What is your bed and what are your sheets? What's your pillow, etc. So again, how can you take care of your sleep environment to make sure it is optimal for sleep? So yeah, we kind of introduced that in 2015. At that World Cup, I remember Alex Morgan, I think Ali Long, and I think Mal Pugh, like them having a picture where they're holding up four fingers, and it's like, we're phase four today. Because again, you just talk about it, and we talked about it with a chef who was male, and almost educated the chef on, okay, if a player's feeling this symptom, let's make sure we have this in the food. Or can, we used to have them do ginger shots, where ginger is a very powerful antioxidant, anti-inflammatory. So I'd always like see him first thing in the morning. I'm like, chef T, have we got our ginger shots? And again, just supporting that individual player. Or if a player came in and said, I'm feeling a bit like this, okay, nutritionally, these are some of the foods that might actually help with that. And try and control it that way rather than straight away give the player pills. Like the last few days I was with a practitioner who's in a leading women's team, and they just said that if a player has any kind of, menstrual cramps or pain, they give medication. And that's what we don't want to do. Like, you don't want to just give them, anti-inflammatory tablets or whatever. Can we actually address it through natural ways of nutrition, hydration, recovery methods, sleep, etc.? So, yeah, just really started that kind of introduction in 2019. The players were great, took it on. There was maybe two or three who didn't want to kind of, kind of have that support, talk about it, didn't want to track, monitor. And again, that's okay. Like, everything is individual in terms of strength. Like, players like to do it different ways. Some like to lift weights, some like to do Olympic lifts, some don't. Some like to do body weight, some like to do TRX, etc., bands, things like that. You can overload in different ways. And, similar, I think it's all the time having that individual lens and support of the individual kind of player or athlete.
And it's important to note that within this context, you're not exactly doing this in low stake, low pressure environments. It's quite the opposite. You're doing it in high stake, high pressure environments, oftentimes within an international camp, oftentimes within a huge tournament in the lead up to big games. So, walking along that threshold or that spectrum from control to guidance, obviously speak there about player empowerment and staff empowerment there. How key a skill do you think that is? And do you think it's completely undervalued within the context of these conversations?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And even that piece of introducing the education around female health, female physiology, menstrual cycle, the first thing, I'm never going to just introduce it without, having the head coach, so Jill Ellis's approval. So again, in the January, I kind of propose it to her and pitched it to her. And, her first thing, which, again, is something that is almost rife in the media at the minute, is, okay, as long as players are not going to have it in their heads that they're going to get injured or ACL injuries or anything like that, because that has been the media's narrative, if you like, over the years. And I was like, absolutely not. And so again, that was kind of key to make sure you didn't scare the players or you didn't put fear into them. But I think it's a great point, because I think as well over my, 20 odd years, and I even did it when I first started at Washington Spirit, like my big thing was like, protein for recovery after a session or hydration fluids to make sure they get electrolytes in. For my 10 years with England and 10 years with US soccer, like I would make those drinks every day and have them at training so that as soon as training finished, you start in that recovery process with the protein and the hydration. At times, other people would say, well, you're doing it for the player. Like, so why not just make it available and they do it themselves? Like, you and I both know compliance is going to be way different if we do that. And I don't know, rightly or wrongly, for me, if you're in that environment with that elite team, and especially in like the tournament mode, tournament situation, like they're the things that can make a difference. Like I always remember Dame Kelly Holmes, who obviously won the 800 and 1500 meters in the Olympics for GB, spoke about after every single heat, she knew that coming off the track, Sally Gunnell, who was a reporter at the time, was going to be the first person that she would see, and she would give her some hydration kind of mixture and a packet of nuts so that she knew straight away, I'm getting some protein and I'm starting that recovery process. And I think that's always been my bit of mentality. Can we start that process straight away? If not, like the way you work with the US women's team and most teams, especially national teams, is you're training somewhere in a facility. You finish your training, you tend to stay there and do your recovery, whatever that might be, ice tubs, pool. And it's probably like, I don't know, 90 minutes, 2 hours until you're back at the hotel, you've showered and you're having your, whatever it might be, lunch or dinner. So my thing all the time was like, can we get some protein into them straight away? Also, if it's whey protein, it's good quality protein. And then depending on which environment you're in, you get some hydration fluid in. So I think that's an interesting question, because I think in that sense, I'm probably criticizing myself because I did that for them. But what I would say over the last couple of years at Washington Spirit, where we did a lot of female health education, Kirsty Hicks, who was at Northumbria University, came into Spirit for the job for a couple of years, is at Northumbria for a while. She kind of led on that element. And the where she got to at the end of the first year was that the players would get an alert around the time that they were going to experience the typical symptoms they had, and they would have a QR code that they could scan, and that would give them their strategy of what they should do. So we very much then started doing that with the players to almost get them empowered, because that's what you want to do. Like you want to educate them, empower them to take control of their own body. So yeah, we did that at a later date with Washington Spirit. I think it's just that fine line and balance of if you know it has an impact, but you know if you don't do it, there's going to be lower compliance. Do you not do it knowing it could impact their recovery or performance? Or do you do it knowing that, okay, if you're going to put it there's probably a greater chance they're going to pick it up and drink it? Even when we did that, and especially at Spirit, and I know it drove our dietitian tail and nuts at times, even though she did make it, kind of most days, if not every day, some players would just leave it. So again, you can only lead the horse to the water, so to speak. You can't make them drink it. I think the other thing we got to with Spirit, we almost had like a gold, silver, bronze, kind of podium for recovery. So especially around like nutrition, hydration. Okay, if you're gold, you're doing all of these things. If you're bronze, you're doing them these, and you're doing it on these days. And if you're silver, you're kind of somewhere in between. So again, it was like we had this minimum expectation that they'd at least hit bronze. And our ideal is to get to gold because that's where we want to be. Like we want to be recovering, and we want to be kind of ready to perform on kind of any day of the cycle, but any day generally, and throughout the season. So again, I think it's that fine line and it's that fine balance. And I think the thing that underpins all of that is the education. And it's the education of the players, but it's also the education of the whole staff to kind of be aligned and the same thinking and the same language of support of, kind of what you're doing. And again, that was a big thing at Spirit going in, like, the vision I presented to Michelle Kang in 2023 was that holistic 360 support of the female athlete, the female underpinning everything we do, the female health education. And the first thing we did was educate the staff, then educate the players. And that was always our lens throughout. And then, the other thing we were working towards was developing that global blueprint for female athlete health and performance support because, again, part of the reason girls drop out of sport at a faster rate than boys, they say, is because they're trained as boys, or they're not given education on female health and menstrual cycle, or they're given their education, but it's from somebody who's not educated in that area. So again, I think that's where we have to normalize that conversation so it does become something that, a young female player can talk to with a male coach or a male practitioner. And also our maybe older male coaches still feel comfortable having that kind of conversation.
Key principle behind the US women's national team success, you remarked earlier on, was when on top, evolve again. And that's something certainly, you certainly played at the edge of the fire in terms of your career, in terms of bringing more awareness regarding female menstrual cycle, doing a PhD at the University of Sydney on female specific training, and then latter years doing a master's in sport and directorship at Manchester Metropolitan University. It's striking to, hear firsthand of basically the motivation and the drive to continue to evolve yourself. Where do you think that comes from, Don?
I think it's a good question. I think again, like in 2009, when I discussed this a lot with Hope Powell, but when I made that decision to leave England, I feel like in part, like for 9 years, and you see it in sport, don't you? Of like, you almost say it's got a shelf life, or don't kind of sit still. And after 9 years, like you've introduced a strategy, a system. I guess my way of periodizing training and supporting the players was a certain way. And I think I'd become exhausted and stale, and you're almost like a bit of monotony of maybe you're doing the same things, even though it's different players coming through the system. But I almost felt like I needed a fresh challenge. And so then you go to the US women, and probably 2019, in some ways I felt similar, but probably also very burnt out because with that team, because for a lot of those years, for 5 6 years, like as US soccer, we almost dictated the schedule and could pull the players outside of FIFA windows. So we had a lot of days, 150, 200 days together every single year. So there's a bit of burnout there. But I think my, even at US soccer, I was like, okay, I've worked 3 World Cups and, was always good. We didn't get the 2011 World Cup. Again, fine margins. You'd worked 3 World Cups, 2 Olympics. And again, part of it is, do the players need fresh input? And also, like, I don't want to do myself a disservice, but like, I was aging and doing warm-ups and things like that. Because even at US soccer until 2016, like, I was the sports science department for the women. So even with a senior women's team, there was only me who traveled and me on the road. So you're doing all of that spectrum of sports science support, the stuff in the gym, the training on the pitch, the periodization, the meeting with the coaches, the nutrition, the hydration, the sleep support, recovery, setting up things, even going to the grocery store and getting the snacks ready for the players between training, et cetera. Like you're doing all of that. And so it is a lot. But then in 2015, 16, we expanded, was able to bring in somebody to head up the sports science with the youth teams in the US, Ellie Mabry, who I'd worked with in England previous, she came out and started working there. Then we brought somebody in to work alongside me, because in 2016 was when we introduced the sports science support to the NWSL. And so it was like, well, I can't do that and support the US team, so we brought somebody else in. So now there was two of us. Now, again, this is where I think probably my leadership, as in managing other staff, journey started then. For 16 years, I'd done it all myself. Like, you'd literally just got stuff done because there wasn't budget resource to bring other people in. And so, when we first brought in the first person to help and support across the league, I didn't really give them autonomy or empower them to do other things. I was always like, okay, well, we've won a World Cup. This is what we're going to do because this works. Rather than I should have been open, like, we've won a World Cup. This is what we did. What do you think? Like, what would be your input? How could we tweak, etc.? And so, he didn't last long because he didn't feel empowered to, give his input. And so he moved on. And so then when the next person came in, Julian Haig, I'd reflected more and I was like, that's not a way of working. That person's not going to have that satisfaction if they come in and they just have to be like a machine and follow what's being done. And that's also not innovation and sports science. So with Julian, it was very much different of like, what do you think? What have you done? He'd worked with Boston Breakers in the NWSL. He'd also worked with Liverpool Women in England. So again, it was, kind of working together and et cetera. But I think that, I guess at the same time I started doing my PhD, so I was also learning there of making sure what I was doing in terms of my processes day to day, because Rick Lovell was my supervisor and probably the best supervisor I could have in terms of his patience with me of, I was working full time and doing this at the same time. And also just how he guided me throughout the whole process. And I think we just worked together really well. And so he made me think and reflect a lot of like my systems and processes with the team. Were they scientific? Were they rigorous? Were there things I should be doing better that would make the data more impactful? Even some simple things like a wellness color coding or certain words are going to really potentially bias the player's response. So, working through that and also how to think about this. And, we did Vamival kind of assessing and, I kind of did it and you got good response and could program from it. But for me, it wasn't then practical to do that longer term or across multiple teams. So again, what could we do to replicate that and, even evolving your physical profile and protocol? So I guess with Rick and the PhD, like, you're continuing to learn, but I'm also on this learning journey or learning journey of leadership. And then finished the US soccer role in 2019, came back to England for a couple of years. And again, this was a really difficult one and difficult time for me. And I think I probably, people don't probably have a very good opinion of me of that time. I came back and I think I was painted one job of what it was in terms of it being kind of more overseeing the performance and not being that practitioner fitness coach on the field. And, I came back and I came in and it was being that kind of fitness coach back on the field. And again, I was like, I didn't really want to be doing that. And again, that's not, people might go, well, that's arrogant. And I'm like, it's not. Like, I'd been doing that for 20 years and I was ready to move on to that next phase and next stage. So I feel like what was on the tin and the reality of what it was within was not matched. And so, I worked 12, 18 months. Phil Neville, who him and Sue Campbell were the probably two big ones who were, kind of contact me to kind of come back for the role. He moved on, tried to introduce the female health kind of education lens. There was pushback on that. It was kind of delayed. And I was like, but like, this is elite support. It's the elite team. Like, you can't just wait 6 months to propose something and then get approval to do it. We want to be, starting the education and doing it now, et cetera. And I just didn't, I don't know. And then obviously Phil moved on. There was an interim coach came in for the Olympics. We got beat, unfortunately, in the quarterfinals, which was absolutely devastating. It would have been amazing to, kind of be with that team and get into the semis, like some of those players, all of those players, obviously with GB England, Kim Little, Steph Horton, Obviously, Jill Scott was in there. Like, it would have been, fantastic. Sophie Ingle, for them to have got into a semi-finals on a major tournament and, potentially gone anywhere in terms of medals. But unfortunately, we didn't. And I think that was hard because, again, Phil had left. They brought in two interim coaches, one whose first language wasn't English. And then it was, just like different staff. And we were just almost like put together a quite quickly before the Olympics, and you go into the Olympics and it wasn't fluid as a MDT, and there was problems with communication and it wasn't clear reporting lines or roles, responsibilities, etc. And it was probably challenging for all staff in there to really know who was in charge, what was the direction, who was making the decisions, etc. And did we have the best support around the team? So again, that was a challenging time. And then obviously, it had been announced that Serena Wiegman was coming in as the new England women's coach, and that was and is exciting for the team. It obviously had success and had won the previous Euros, and with the US, we played against Holland in the Netherlands in the 2019 World Cup. And I had two conversations with her about the role, and she'd just seen the role as kind of what it still was of doing the warm-ups on the pitch and not really that kind of overseeing the performance. And it was a really hard decision because it was like 12 months out from a home European Championships, and I made the decision to leave because I just wanted more than that at that time in my career. I didn't want to, one, I was older, and I didn't want to still be doing the warm-ups with the players because I just feel like that would be doing them a disservice, and I wasn't as flexible and as kind of able to do some of that. And there was new ideas and new thinking compared to, probably some of my methods from previous. And so I made that decision to leave there. And that was a really hard decision being a year out. And, when England won the European Championships, I happened to be back home because obviously it was kind of post-COVID, and my mum had to kind of have some kind of surgery. So I was back in England because at that time I'd gone out to Miami to work with Phil again. But I was back in England for my mum, who was in hospital. And, England won the Euros, and you watched it. And, it was like tears, but combined tears of like joy for the team and the players. Like Jill Scott, Ellen White, who'd been there for so long and not had that success. But, like some tears of sadness of not, like stayed and been part of it, but was just so pleased for the people involved there because it had been so long since well, it was the first kind of major success for an England women's national team. So yeah, it's just kind of an interesting journey there. I can't remember how we started on that question.
No, but no, see, this is the point of it. I mean, listen to those anecdotes. It's, yeah, surreal to be on the other end. And
No, you asked about the growth, and so actually,
yeah.
it was during my time back in England. Again, Sam Erith, Tony Strudwick, who I mentioned previously, I'd seen that they'd done a course, Masters in Sports Directorship at Manchester Met, and so I spoke to both of them about it, and then I inquired about the course, and I started that course, and the first module of the course, which I think was in 2021, was on leadership, and that just kind of lit this kind of passion and thirst to kind of learn more about the leadership. Like I say, I'd had that uncomfortable time at US Soccer, like of like you almost grow, like this, like you grow from being a practitioner to suddenly leading or managing staff without really knowing it and without really being a hierarchy or structure or whatever. And like you're still doing the job and you're really working alongside these people, but you're also supposed to be leading and maybe setting the vision. And then some actually progress beyond that and are no longer on the field, but like are in this leadership where they're now leading people who used to be their peers, like working alongside. And I think in sports science, we don't do a good job of giving those people who do progress like that, that support as leaders. And so, yeah, sign up to do the Masters in Sports Directorship, which remember, I was still doing my PhD. So, the first module was on leadership, and one of the first things we had on there was an opportunity to do business coaching, so be coached. And as part of that process, my coach did psychometric profiling, be co called Spotlight Profiling. And Spotlight Profiling, again, psychometric profile, you answer a few questions, and then it outlines what are your preferences, and how does that change in certain situations. And for me, that is and has been massive in terms of my own self-development of knowing who I am. And, you know, that example I gave before of like working hard. One of my kind of watch out points is like if there's a stressful situation or a deadline, because of this work ethic, I'll just kind of push on and get this work done. Now, how does Connor perceive that? Connor perceives that of like, okay, you've just gone and done that work and not included me. Why is she not including me in that? So I'm thinking I'm doing good by just getting it done and meeting the deadline. But you're thinking, well, why wasn't I involved in that? So for me, it's just been massive, the course. And then, you know, even since then, so 2021, I've literally had regular kind of business exec coaching where, you know, you talk through different situations or, you reflect a lot, you know, like the self-reflection you spoke about, like journaling, you know, just reflecting who I am, thinking about how you interact with others, building a department, you know, again, going into Miami, it was do a review of the current environment and then what do I think was needed in terms of the high performance, and then getting to know each individual member of staff and then piecing together that department. So, you know, gone in and done a review of kind of a system that was in place with some tweaks. Then the next one was Washington Spirit, where it was do a review of the department and there was very little in place. There was literally kind of one performance person, three athletic trainers, and that was pretty much it. There wasn't any consistent technology, wasn't really any systems, structure, processes, kind of no meetings, not really much interaction with the technical. So that was a very different situation or kind of analysis than the Inter Miami. And so Washington Spirit from the outset, okay, it was a review, it was get to know the individual staff. We advertised the roles, and even those staff who were still there had to apply and go through that process. But also it was like making sure it's not just me on the interview panel, because then it's my biased view and opinion. So how can we make sure there's diversity on the panel and it's not just one person's opinion? And even, you know, proposing that idea to Michelle Kang of train women as women, the female athlete being central, you know, being global leaders in terms of that female athlete support, developing that global blueprint for female athlete health and performance. So again, that was kind of the idea pitched, and hires were based around that. So again, you know, proposed a department to Michelle, which was a big department of 17 staff on the performance and medical, and we had three PhD students in there. And then it was okay, building out the job descriptions on the back of that. What do they look like? Putting them out for recruitment, you know, getting a couple of the key positions in place, and then them becoming involved in that recruitment process. I typically have like three or four levels of that. Of one is you put out the JD, you get the applications in, so already you're reviewing the applications. What I would say on anybody applying is keep that short, sweet, concise, because if 100, 200 people have applied for something, you are skim reading. So I think the short, concise, get your key information out there. The next one for me is a very informal like chat of me plus at least one other of the person. Does the person seem like the right fit? Gauge on some of their basic principles, understanding of working with female athletes, just saying that females think or act differently is not good enough, knowing a little bit more about the physiology and the mental. And then the third level is going into the expertise like of that role of that subject, maybe have them present. And then if you need to go to a final, you go to a final based on how many were involved in the kind of rest of it. And you know, probably over the last 3 years I did close to 200-300 interviews for various roles across the different systems. Didn't always get it right. Even at, you know, Spirit, we delayed appointing the dietitian, the nutritionist, because we didn't find the right person. I think we went to advert two or three times until we did find the right person. And again, in 2020, I have to keep looking at my calendar, 2023, our first training camp we had in Florida, I was in my room with a blender making those damn shakes again for the players because we didn't have a nutritionist yet. And, you know, part of my way of leading is like model the way. Like I'm going to get in the trenches like everybody else. Like I'm not going to say to one of our other staff, oh, we haven't got a nutritionist or a dietitian yet. At 11 p.m. when we finish our meetings, I want you to go and prepare those drinks. It was no, I'll do it. Okay, can anybody help? Like, okay, great. Yep, you're free. You can help. Great. When you lead, you want to lead sometimes behind everybody else, sometimes alongside, and sometimes in the front. So again, how can I flex how I am in those situations? And again, having that department of 17, I wanted to make sure I got to know everybody. So in that first year, it was having individual meetings with each of those people at least 3 times throughout the year. So the first one initially, like, how are you doing? How are you finding it? Is there anything you need help on? What can we do? Where do you envision going? Mid-season, how's it going? Da, da, da. Same at the end. Some of those conversations are different at the end because we had a couple of staff leave at the end, and then we transition and change and bring other people in. I think the other thing we did massively as a department that first year was, again, we had a vision, if you like, for the department of like train women as women and that whole female athlete focus. But what are our values? What were our behaviors, actions associated to those values? And it couldn't just be my values. So as a department, we did a lot of work and a lot of meetings of, what's your why? Why are you here? What's important to you? What value is important to you? And then collectively came up with a list of values that as a department we agreed on and we were happy with. I think the one thing, and I don't necessarily mean about that group or that situation, is I think sometimes like culture values, the words are too easy. Like, what are the actions? What are the behaviors? Are we holding each other accountable for what they are? Even some of the basic values like integrity, honesty, trust, like they should be your core principles, and it shouldn't just be a given. Like, yeah, we do those because many people do not do those. And what is integrity? And communication is important for all of those, and honesty and trust. And so again, like, we did a lot of work around that in the first year, and at times check, challenge each other, as well as building out our system strategies, what technology we were going to use. Again, it was a clean slate. Like, Ross came in as our head of physical performance. Kirsty Hicks was still trying to work on her visa, so she wasn't there. Like, we had Song Kim came in as our applied sports scientist. Again, she didn't have a visa, so again, Adam literally flew in. Then the next day, we're doing physical profile, and so we'd met about it, and we knew what we were going to do. We get there, it's like last week in January, so it's freezing. We're out on the AstroTurf in DC. We were doing the 3015 was our physical profiling test, and Adam hadn't done it before. So again, we'd gone through it online, and then we're there and we're doing it live, but stuff's flying everywhere. And it wasn't perfect, but we reflect and we're like, okay, next year we now know the conditions in Washington, DC. Like, we'll do the profiling inside where we know we can at least control the elements. Okay, now what testing do we need to do? So again, like, the mistakes then of, okay, that's not going to work there. We need to do it this way, or we're going to do this test, or monitor this way, because actually we did these tests and we didn't use any of the data. So, what else can we do that we would use? So again, that whole reflecting piece all of the time of, kind of what are our system strategies, and trying to involve everybody in that process, which, when you've got a group of 17 in the department, is hard and challenging because you're mindful of everybody's time, but everybody wants to be part of it, rightly so, and you want to keep everybody communicated in terms of kind of what you are doing. So we did every single day have a morning meeting with all of the staff, and then at the end of the day, similar kind of meeting to debrief the day where everybody had a voice to kind of speak up. And then after or before each of those meetings, a smaller group would then go and meet with the technical coaches to finalize the plan and all debrief the loads kind of at the end of the day. So it's a lot. It's a lot, and it's not easy. And I think these are some things that are just unwritten. And I don't know. I just feel like, especially in applied sports science, I feel like we need more help, guidance, support on some of these areas because it is challenging. And you also, in your eyes, might be the best leader or have the right intentions. But again, when you've got bigger groups, like if one person doesn't agree or has a different view or vision and pulls a different way and slows the bus down or gets off the bus, that can disrupt everything else. But are you always going to make everybody happy? Because, your preferences can be so different. So again, I think it's that being tolerant a little bit, being open to learning how other people are work and operate, and at times maybe flexing to get the best out of each other, but not criticizing, because again, if I have a certain way of being or doing something, it's not bad. It's just that's kind of my preference, but also it doesn't mean I can't be different. Like you can almost flex and change it in different situations.
Organizational design seems to me, something that you've been thinking about an awful lot recently, from obviously being involved within it and obviously being in charge of it from the top down, and obviously doing your master's on it too. I mean, there seems to be a lot more to come in the next few years in terms of research regarding bespoke organizational design, regarding the best principles in terms of practice and whatnot. But if for me nowadays, it seems just from conversations such as this on a podcast and obviously off air too, there's an awful lot of clubs and associations, governing bodies, nearly kind of beset by novelty in terms of you want to be able to kind of view the novelty from above and kind of pick and choose intentionally regarding what you want to do, where there's an awful lot of noise at the moment, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, and I think, like, for me, I don't think there's one set way of doing it. And also, I think, especially in the women's game at the minute, I think we don't just have to adopt what's being done on the men's side, because that's not necessarily always the best way, or that maybe doesn't apply to the females' kind of environment. So I think, I think I have a phrase at the minute of like, be brave to do it differently and be curious, because, and also be brave to do it wrong or make mistakes, because you're not always going to get it wrong. But for me, there's also no wrong decisions as long as you learn from it. It's kind of learning moments. So again, I think all the time it's be curious, try different things, see what might work. Even like the types of role in a department, like, should you have the title of, I don't know what it might be, a sports scientist or a fitness coach, or is there a different title, or what does it matter? Like, again, I don't know. Like, I think, yeah, I just think, what is your environment? What do you need? Like, who are your key people? But even like, how do you set up within the department? What is even the structural hierarchy within there? I know some systems who are very flat systems, but then who ultimately is the decision maker? Because somebody somewhere has to make a decision. And even at Spirit, we started off with kind of myself as a very American term of vice president, I think it was, of performance and innovation. And then had somebody who headed up the medical side and somebody who headed up the high performance side. And then the next year, when kind of my role became more global, because I did a similar review and recruitment for Olympic Lyonnais and then London City Lionesses. So I was almost like less and less involved at DC, because I travel for over 100 years across 100 years, 100 days. Oh my goodness. 100 days across those other two clubs. It felt like 100 years sometimes. And so I was less present in DC. So we almost like split that into kind of four strands. And we had a physical performance strand, with four staff under there. Then we had female health and innovation, with the three PhD students and our nutritionist sat in there. And then we had a mental performance strand and then medical. So now what we had was almost like me as that VP of performance and innovation, but then four leaders kind of day to day. And then you had, kind of the other staff reporting up into there. So for me, I think then it almost became those four leaders were really key in terms of the communication, setting the vision, setting the values. My touch points with them were key. But even when we changed that system from the two leads to the four, for me, the communication of that, of everybody's role, the roles and responsibilities, the structure, the hierarchy, the communication lines is so key, because again, it's probably something I've learned where my role did change and evolve, of just being that VP of performance and innovation for Spirit to doing the global piece across the three clubs, to then also doing some work in the Kinniska Innovation Hub. And you're kind of getting pulled, and then, I'm passionate about what I do. I love what I do. I work hard. So you just like, yeah, I'll go to Lyon and do that review. Yeah, I'll do that at London City. And, I really enjoy going in and doing the review and helping with the recruitment and setting up systems and strategies. But then I was almost getting pulled of like, okay, which one should be the priority of what I am doing? And so I probably didn't seek out that clarity. And that is one thing, if I reflect back. I would have done earlier of like, kind of what is the clarity of what I should be focused on most at what time. And again, if I was, to set up another department or, consult somewhere, that would be something that would be key for me. Like, what is the best structure or optimal structure for that club or environment? Is everybody's role and responsibility clear? And, even within that, do you have to actually break down, you get there on the day, like whose responsibility is it to, I don't know, set up the GPS so that the players can pick them up and go here, make the drinks, whatever it might be. I think to that detail is important, especially for practitioners who don't come from, I don't know, the sporting kind of arena, or it might be their first role as an applied sports scientist or similar. So again, I just think that clarity is so important. So if you have that clarity, then you can almost hold some of that staff accountable if, kind of something is missed, or it just helps with better communication or better satisfaction because people do know their roles rather than the ambiguity of what is it that everybody should be doing, or if something doesn't get done, well, who should have done it? Well, we don't know because it's not clear whose role it is. So I just think that clarity is really important, yeah, to make sure people are aware. But then just even that self-awareness of self, because in that second year at Spirit, all 17 staff in the department did the spotlight profiling, and we all learned about ourselves, and then we all learned about how we interacted with others, and almost as a department, what our strengths and weaknesses were, what, not weaknesses, they call it blind spots, but what our blind spots were of, because we are so strong in these areas, these are some blind spots we need to look out for. And that's one thing. Actually, next week, I'm actually going to do the spotlight accreditation to then be able to use that spotlight kind of profile. And if, I do kind of mentor or coach, other practitioners or other people kind of working in the sporting world or business world, because it, for me, it's very transferable, business to sport, sport to business.
It's amazing, and obviously Spotlight is something I'm familiar with myself, but to use it in that lens, very, very similar to the Johari window in terms of just identifying those blind spots in terms of communication is something I'll lean more into. But as you reflected upon this podcast again, I mean, I think again you stress how 24/7 really it is to be working in football. And that hasn't subsided over the years. If not, it's got a little bit more complex with the emergence of technology and the commercialization of the sport and whatnot. But recently you've took a few months of a break, after getting off the treadmill and being on it 25, 30 years, Dawn. I mean, any reflections regarding potential next steps?
Good question. Yeah, not 100%. I think in part it's, what opportunities might be out there. I think a reflective when I trained and I guess how I've progressed through, I'm very much a generalist, rather than, again, I think about recruitment over the last few years where you're specifically recruiting a strength and conditioning coach who is an expert in the gym. Like we brought somebody in from MMA at Washington Spirit who's absolutely excellent in the gym. So again, I'm more of a generalist across all of the realms. But also, I think, even when I first went into Spirit 3 years ago, I think I was still in that headspace of like, how much do I need to be involved in the planning and periodization of, the training day to day? And I think gradually over 18 months in that role, like I moved away from that and felt at peace and ease with that of more being about, kind of building out the department and the vision, the values, the structure. So it's definitely that area I now feel, I don't know, like now excites me and challenges me of continuing to learn about myself, of continuing to review other departments and see what's there. Just learning really the landscape of women's sport, women's football in England, having been in the US for 13 of the last 15 years. It's very different to when I was, kind of working here last. So, honestly, don't know. Like I say, doing the spotlight profiling. So, potentially, like the mentoring support, the coaching. Also, actually, since 2015, I've done some consultancy with FIFA. Started off by doing some of the physical demands of the World Cups in 15, 19, 23. And then over the last 2 or 3 years, worked on some programs on physical performance mentoring, some female health education, making that globally accessible. Yeah, just kind of continuing to see if there's opportunities, potential there. Yeah, and just having conversations with people and, seeing what might be possible as alongside continuing to kind of learn and grow as a person leader and, I don't know, somebody who's passionate about the growth of women's sport.
And obviously, as someone who's been a tremendous trailblazer regarding that, for anyone that's slightly been inspired, Dawn, by your journey today, and again, I have to give you a huge thank you for coming on today and sharing about your experiences. What would be the one bit of key advice you'd have for anyone?
Oh, that's a good one. I think I'm going to go with two bits of advice. If you think no, say yes, because that means it's something challenging. Whatever it might be, it might be going to a meeting where you feel nervous, or I don't know, taking a job opportunity. Because I think linking to that, there's no wrong decisions. And I think the other one is, as a female, like, be brave and be confident to have a voice. If I'm honest, probably for, I don't know, 20 years, I didn't really have a voice and didn't feel confident speaking up at times. And, in some environments, I still don't. And I think as females, we need to do that, because I think sport is male dominated, still is male dominated. I even think in women's football now, salaries are higher, budgets are higher, and we're getting more practitioners, coaches coming in from men's sport and men's game. And male, female, like, I'm not saying everybody has to be female, but it's a different lens of support on male players. And I think as females, we have a different lens of how we should support females. So I think having that voice, and I don't know, I just feel, sorry, I know this has gone off pat, but if clubs or systems don't feel like they've got a female who's qualified for that role or has the experience, then develop some kind of mentorship program or pathway to give females that opportunity or to mentor them so that they can get into those roles. There's some clubs now where a sporting director, GM, head coach, technical director are all male and all white male. So again, I'm talking about gender, but what about race? What about skin color? Because there's diversity of thinking. Like, if you look the same, chances are you're going to think the same and act the same. And there's even that lens, and Deloitte have done studies of that, of diversity of thinking by gender, culture, race, skin color. So, I just think women's games come so far, increasing professional, still not professionalized. And I still think we've got lots of work to do, but I think we have to have that awareness piece as well of what we can do. Okay, if we say there's no qualified female or experienced female for certain positions, can we, as a club or as federations or organizations, put pathways in place to give females an opportunity? Like, I go back to the role model piece, and even when you say trailblazer and role model, like, part of me feels embarrassed, but then part of me's like, don't think like that, because if people can see me, then people, girls can see that there is an opportunity to be in this position. When I was young, I didn't think girls could play football. I played in the street with the boys, but I didn't think I could play for a team. Similar, I didn't think there was any kind of role in applied sports science in women's football or women's sports. So, yeah, sorry, a lot of things kind of built into that. So if you think no, say yes, because then you're going to push yourself outside of your comfort zone and be brave and confident to have a voice as a female.
Fantastic. What a way to close the show. Don Scott, big thank you for coming on again today.
Thanks, Connor. Enjoyed it. See you soon.